to this panel on the pursuit of wisdom in the age of the internet. Before I begin, Bill Campbell asked me to make a couple of announcements to remind you that Liberty Fund has a special offer for four of our publications, The Good Riches and American Family, Why Liberty, a collection of Liberty Fund essays, Can Capitalism Survive, a collection of essays by Ben Rogge, and to be published next August, another collection of writings by Ben Rogge, edited by Dwight Lee, A Maverick's Defense of Freedom, Selected Writings and Speeches of Benjamin A. Rogge. So if you want to order those, order sheets are right up front. Bill also asked me to remind you of the next national meeting, which will take place April 9th to 11th in Philadelphia. The topic is American Exceptionalism Properly Understood. I learned a few months ago the answer to a question that had on occasion come to mind when I was sitting out in the audience at Philadelphia Society panels, and that question was, why is the chairman for the session actually delivering a talk instead of just introducing his participants? And the answer is because Bill sometimes seduces people into chairing panels by encouraging them to make the remarks they would have liked to have made. So it's like a Venus flytrap. I wrote Bill a number of months ago and said, if you've got any space on the program, I'd like to talk for a few minutes on conversation as a discovery process. And he said, that's a great idea. Why don't you chair the panel on wisdom in the age of the internet, and you can make your remarks as part of the opening remarks. So I will do that. First, I want to introduce our distinguished panel, and then I will make a few remarks, and then we will go right to the panel. Sitting on my right is Dick Bajerian, president and professor of government at Georgetown University, an online university, but he is also the founder of that university. And he thinks that we all should found our own universities and make ourselves presidents and full professors and steal students away from other universities. Second will come E. Christian Kopp, who since 1973 has taught at the University of Colorado in Boulder. He's the associate director of the honors program there. He is author of an ISI book that many of you probably know and have read, The Devil Knows Latin, Why America Needs the Classical Tradition. And our third speaker is James Bowman, a resident scholar at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He has been a freelance journalist since 1989. He is an American letter for the Times Literary Supplement. For a number of years, he is a movie critic for the American Spectator, a media critic for the New Criterion. So, with that, let me make a few remarks about, before we get into the internet, about an old-fashioned way of communicating, and that is conversation. In March of 1968, Friedrich Hayek addressed the Philadelphia Society on the topic, Competition is a Discovery Process. I want to briefly outline what he said in that address. His premises, first, if one or a small group of people knew all of the relevant economic data, competition would be a wasteful method for securing adjustment to those facts. Secondly, Hayek said, whatever the use of competition is rationally justified, it is on the ground that we do not know in advance the facts that determine the actions of competitors. The bulk of Hayek's lecture was devoted to a consideration of competition as a procedure for the discovery of such facts as, without resort to it, would not be known by anyone. One of Hayek's preliminary conclusions was that competition is valuable because its results are unpredictable and that the whole, and on the whole, different from those which anyone has or could have deliberately acted upon. The spontaneous order, or perhaps better, the spontaneous ordering of the market is different from that of an economy, Hayek argued. An economy he said, in the strict sense of the word, is an organization or arrangement in which someone deliberately allocates resources to a unitary order of ends. Spontaneous order produced by the market is nothing of the kind, and in important respects, it does not behave like an economy proper. In particular, such spontaneous order differs because it does not ensure that what general opinion regards as the most important needs are always satisfied before the less important ones. Hayek emphasized that market results cannot be assessed in terms of a single scale of values. In fact, the market is interesting because it is, in some ways, he suggests, purposeless. He said, though the existence of a spontaneous order is not made for a particular purpose, cannot be properly said to have a purpose, it may yet be highly conducive to the achievement of many different individual purposes not known as a whole to any single person or relatively small group of persons. Now let me turn to another thinker, Michael Oakeshott, and suggest that however unlikely it might appear at first glance, Oakeshott's understanding of conversation has at least a few important elements in common with Hayek's model of competitive spontaneous order. In an early essay by Oakeshott entitled The Voice of Conversation in the Education of Mankind, he draws a line between conversation and other forms of human talk. Conversation is not an argument, not a debate, not a symposium under the direction of a symposiarch. Its tone is colloquial, but it is not a colloquy. There are many enemies of conversation that Oakeshott lists, but among those are persons who always talk to win and persons who won't be silent until refuted. Oakeshott argues that conversation is a fine art, maybe the most civilized of arts, but it's not necessarily the highest art. But it does have some virtues, and it has some strengths. In fact, Oakeshott thinks that conversation has the potential to civilize philosophy, to civilize politics, and to neutralize what he calls ideological rage. Conversation can be external or it can be internal to one individual. Those who are disposed to think conversationally will use the voice of conversation even when they are alone and speak only to themselves. Indeed, all the characteristics of conversational talk, the readiness of sympathy, the forbearance from dogmatism, the naive pleasure in the exchange of ideas, the generosity of giving and taking, the intoxicating blend of the consequential and the inconsequential, the internal discipline combined with an absence of a route to be taken or a conclusion to be reached. These characteristics are only the images of a certain manner of thinking, of a certain intellectual temperament which does not require the presence of others in order to be active. How is it that we know that we don't know? In some cases, it may be obvious. We fail the test. Maybe a classroom test, or it may be a test in life in which we're trying to solve a problem and we can't solve it. But I am thinking more broadly than personal ignorance or even social ignorance. Is there a realm that humankind doesn't know about, that humankind doesn't even know exists? How can we gain a purchase on that realm we don't know about and don't even know we don't know about? Pierre Goodrich, founder of Liberty Fund, talks about man's impressive ignorance in relation to his nature, his origins, and his destiny. While that ignorance may be impressive, it is not necessarily impenetrable or invincible. The material which conversation concerns itself with, according to Oakeshott, is the possible and the probable, or in Aristotle's words, the contingent things, not the necessary things that are the subject of theoretical science. But for Oakeshott, conversation is not a practical science either. It's something else. Let me suggest that conversation, as Oakeshott describes it, may give us an entry into those realms unknown. Before turning to Oakeshott's better-known essay, The Voice of Poetry in the Conversation of Mankind, I want to commend to you a talk by Robert Frost, Education by Poetry. Says Frost, I have wanted in later years to go further and further in making metaphor the whole of thinking. Metaphor allows us to make previously unseen connections, to see relationships we never saw before. And as Frost illustrates, the use of metaphor permeates almost every area of human life. Frost warns, unless you are at home in the metaphor, you are not safe anywhere. With that, let me quote the mature Oakeshott's understanding of the nature of conversation, if I can find it. Well, I can't find it, so that will save us a little time. And I will tell you what the mature Oakeshott says. The mature Oakeshott says that conversation requires a diversity of voices. Without that diversity of voices, we can have lots of things. We can have prayer meetings, party rallies, pep rallies, but we can't have a conversation because that conversation requires, here we go, that conversation, I'll pick up where I am. In conversation, facts appear only to be resolved once more into possibilities from which they were made. Certainties are shown to be combustible, not but by being brought in contact with other certainties or with doubt, but by being kindled by the presence of ideas of another order. Approximations revealed between notions normally remote one from another. Thoughts of different species take wing and play around one another, responding to each other's movements and provoking one another to fresh exertions. Nobody asks where they have come from or on what authority they are present. Nobody cares what will become of them when they have played their part. Every entrant is taken at its face value, and everything is permitted which can get itself accepted into the flow of speculation. And the voices which speak in conversation do not compose a hierarchy. Conversation is not an enterprise designed to yield an extrinsic profit, a contest where the winner gets a prize, nor is it an activity of exegesis. It is an unrehearsed intellectual adventure. It is with conversation as with gambling. Its significance lies neither in the winning nor in the losing, but in wagering. Properly speaking, it is impossible in the absence of a diversity of voices. Different universes of discourse meet, acknowledge each other, and enjoy an oblique relationship which neither requires nor forecasts their being assimilated to one another. Now, let me just highlight that there are at least three similarities between Oakeshott's conversation and Hayek's competition. First, each houses a diversity of goals or modes. Second, neither is subject to a unitary hierarchy of values. And third, both may lead to totally unexpected results. In the interplay of divergent voices, the reflected light may shine on new facets of old areas of study, often because of the naive emperor's clothes questions often asked by a novice. Those questions allow the expert himself to reorient himself and delve into hitherto unsuspected depths. In conversation, we may discover a hidden piece of a puzzle we didn't even know was missing. And we further discover that that missing piece fits into many puzzles and makes them all more complete. Thus, the philosopher, the historian, the sociologist, the student of religion, the lawyer, and the professor of literature may appropriate the newly recovered piece and apply it to their interests without hindering others from doing the same. in commencement remarks that he made at Sarah Lawrence in 1956, Robert Frost challenged his listeners to take interest in a number of important issues, what he called their knitting, that they would keep with them and pick up in odd moments over their entire life. Not just to pick up with uncertainty, but to pick up, to knit, to have ideas about. Not to opinionate about, but to have ideas about. That's something more. Opinion is just pro and con, having your nose counted. If I have an idea about it, it isn't just an opinion. And then Frost shared with those graduates some of his recent knitting. For years, he had knitted about what he calls the dream. I wonder how much you have encountered it. I have it thrown in my face every little while, and always by someone who thinks the dream has not come true. And then the next time I pick it up to knit, I wonder what the dream is and why. And the next time I pick it up, I wonder who dreamed it. Did Tom Paine dream it? Did Thomas Jefferson dream it? Did George Washington dream it? Governor Morris? And lately, I've decided the best dreamer of it was Madison. I have been reading the Federalist Papers. But anyway, I am always concerned with the question, is it a dream that's gone by? Each age is a dream that is dying, they say, or one that is coming to birth. Now, I know, I think I know, as of today at least, what Madison's dream was. It was just a dream of a new land to fulfill with people in self-control. In self-control. That is all through his thinking. And let me say that again to you, to fulfill this land, the new land, with people in self-control. That's probably a piece of knitting we've all engaged in over time. So in conclusion, before Dick comes to the platform, I finish with two pieces of advice. First, in the words of David Hume, stay conversable. And secondly, whatever else you do, stick to your knitting.